Mountain Edition, all the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. This week, Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron meets with our neighbors to the north about climate action, and we'll hear an update on Sandra Lopez, the woman currently in sanctuary in Carbondale. Plus, transportation is a priority for Colorado lawmakers this session, but where the money to fund improvements might come from is up for debate.
Also, we'll talk to comedian Mike Birbiglia, a funny guy who's pretty serious about the influence that This American Life's Ira Glass had on him. And we'll hear about an art class in Basalt that offers a place of respite for cancer patients.
The biggest stories from this week, coming up on Mountain Edition.
Research from the University of Colorado Boulder has established a link between a warming climate and extinction of a common mountain wildflower.
Researchers at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory near Crested Butte simulated a warmer, drier climate and found that wild jasmine could not adapt and survive. Their field site has a warming meadow that uses infrared radiators to warm certain areas in ways that mimic climate change. Scientists raised the average soil temperature by 3 degrees and decreased the moisture in the soil by 20%. They also mimicked an earlier snowmelt date, all to simulate climate change. The study was published in the journal Science Advances. A sitcom about the quirks of life in Aspen premieres tonight on Grassroots TV. Arts and culture reporter Claire Woodcock reports.
Aspen the Series is the semi-autobiographical story of producer Greg Simmons. The concept for a national show about life in Aspen began in 2002. Simmons also launched a reality show about making the show, which became its own web series. A decade later, Simmons says he was financially underwater and it got so bad he had to sell his house.
Literally, my family and friends were begging me to stop.
After a six-year hiatus, the show will get its television debut on Grassroots TV tonight. The first two episodes, as well as a mini-documentary, are now a part of the channel's program schedule. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson, Arts and Culture Desk.
A woman in Carbondale hasn't stepped outside in 4 months. Sandra Lopez is in sanctuary with her young daughter.
They're living in the basement of a parsonage that belongs to the Two Rivers Unitarian Universalist Congregation. As Wyatt Orm reports, Lopez will remain there indefinitely, feeling she has no choice.
Sandra Lopez is having a yoga class.
Is it a good stretch?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel very good.
Can you relax back down?
Her teacher comes once a week. After yoga, it's time for an English lesson. Lopez and her tutor practice hard words, like dwarf.
Dwarf.
No. Try again. Come on, you can do it.
Lopez is basically under house arrest, so distractions like these are welcome. Sanctuary is tedious and boring, and the most distressing part is not knowing when it's going to end.
When you enter sanctuary, you know the date, the hour, the minute. You know all that. But you don't know when you're going to leave. It could be months. It could be years.
What if it is years? Is Lopez ready for that? Is the congregation ready for that?
I think so. And I'm hopeful that it won't be that long.
Reverend Shauna Foster is the minister of Two Rivers Unitarian Universalist. She lives at the parsonage with her family. Opening their home to Lopez, she says, was a no-brainer.
If Sandra's deported, that's 3 children without a mom. Is that really what you want? Is that your sense of justice? Is that what the laws are for?
The risks for the congregation have been harder to discern. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, knows exactly where Lopez is, Foster told them. The agency has a policy of not raiding what they call sensitive places, like churches and schools. But what if ICE comes after Foster, sending her to jail, leaving her kids without a parent?
That's what happens to people who are deported every day. Every day in this country, there are kids left without parents. And how could I just say, well, no, I'm not going to take that risk, when I can see it's happening here in this very community?
In addition to taking her in, the congregation has raised $10,000 for Lopez's legal expenses, which she can no longer afford because she doesn't work. And they've set up another fund to help her family in Silt, who now has one fewer income earner. Lopez's oldest son, Alex, had been in college studying to become a mechanic. Without his mom's help, he couldn't afford the tuition, so he dropped out and is now looking for a job.
This is going to take a while just to finish my education.
That's not even his main concern. His main concern is his mom. And while he's proud she's brought attention to the plight of undocumented people and that there's a whole community rallying behind her.
I just wanted to stop. I just wanted to stop.
For now, though, this is life. Lopez's attorneys have asked the government to reopen her case, but that could take years. Of course, she's grateful to be in sanctuary.
But I don't belong here.
Still, remaining behind these walls is worth it. She talks to her husband on FaceTime each night, gets to see her sons when they visit, and always has her daughter by her side. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning into Mountain Edition. You are listening during our Many Voices Wen Valley Pledge Drive. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Kristen Kay.
You just heard that story from Benta Berkland coming from the state capitol. We bring you local news, state house news, national and international news from NPR, and that all costs money. Please lend your support today for this kind of high-quality news reporting that covers all the issues that you care about.
You know, I think we hear a lot about people getting their news in a bubble, and Mountain Edition and what you hear on Aspen Public Radio is such a good example of how, really, if you're listening, you get stories that run the gamut. You don't pick and choose the stories that you hear, you just listen, and you get such a wide range of voices.
Give us a call at 920-9000 or go online to aspenpublicradio.org to show your support today. Maybe you're listening via podcast, because Mountain Edition is a great way for you to stay informed about what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley. If you take a week out to go on vacation, or maybe you don't live here, you come here part of the year. If Mountain Edition is your link to the Roaring Fork Valley, give us a call to support that, 920-9000 or aspenpublicradio.org.
And thank you. Today, Aspen Mayor Steve Scadron will meet with Canada's Minister of Environment and Climate Change.
Canadian Minister Catherine McKenna will be in Denver for the Climate Leadership Conference. She requested a meeting with Scadron to discuss how cities are meeting goals to reduce their carbon footprint. Scadron says he's open to collaborating with McKenna.
And I'm quite encouraged that Aspen's initiatives have the opportunity to inform international conversations.
Scadron says he's planning a quick trip to Denver for the meeting Thursday and is not scheduled to attend the conference.
Mike Birbiglia loves telling jokes, as he says in his new Netflix special, Thank God for Jokes. He was in town recently for the Aspen Laugh Festival.
He's also a longtime storyteller for The Moth and This American Life. Claire Woodcock spoke with him about what it's been like working with Ira Glass.
Ira Glass is, he's produced both of my movies, Sleepwalk With Me and Don't Think Twice, and he's going to be a producer officially on this new show that I'm bringing to Aspen called The New One when it goes off Broadway eventually. Working with him is a dream come true, because he was someone I admired for many, many years before I knew him, and I feel like what he does when he works with me is he just sort of, he tries to understand the story underneath the story. And so if I'll tell him a story, for example, like the story from my girlfriend's boyfriend, where I was hit by a drunk driver and made to pay for the other driver's car, I told him that story in his office, and he was sort of like, what else? Like, what else happened that week? What was on your mind? And what was, and that's sort of how we discovered this whole idea that I was in a pivotal moment in my relationship where I was considering whether or not I was going to get married or not, or like what was going to happen. And he was the person who was like, oh, those two ideas should be one. Like, you could tell those as one story, and that's really an interesting way to do it. And so, like, I feel like the biggest thing that he's done for me is, in addition to just championing my work, is like forcing me to dig deeper and talk about things that are uncomfortable.
And can you tell me a story about the first time you ever worked with Ira Glass?
I had told my sleepwalking story. if people don't know it, is a story about how I jumped through a second story window of a La Quinta Inn in Walla Walla, Washington while sleepwalking. At the time, I just told it on stage at the Moth, and I asked Catherine Burns at the Moth if she would consider sending it to This American Life, and then they expressed an interest in putting it on the air, and my trepidation was, once it was on the radio, that I couldn't perform it in my shows anymore, because it was almost like releasing an album. So I said that to Julie Snyder, the producer at This American Life, and she had Ira call me, who I'd never spoken to, and he goes, look, he was like, I understand what you're saying about not wanting to put your story on the show, but also the exposure of the amount of people that the show reaches is so many more people than your albums reach that you'll really be glad that you put it on the show.
People living with autism face challenges with social skills and communication. Many services are aimed at children with the disorder, but adults often need support too. Ascendigo Autism Services, based in Carbondale, offers outdoor recreation camps and teaches life skills. Kristen sat down with CEO and President Peter Bell to talk about the importance of building community to support those living with autism.
What obstacles do you see affecting adults with autism?
I think as a society, we're still coming to grips with the fact that autism is not just a childhood disorder, that these kids do grow up, they become teenagers, they become adults. Some go off to college and, they struggle to fit in and they may not have the supports that they need to be able to be successful. But I think the other thing is that as a society, we also need to recognize that people are all different and people with autism present in very different ways. And sometimes they're not necessarily easy and attractive, and people may not know how to approach an individual that has autism. So a lot of it comes down to education and awareness. And it's one of the reasons why we're here in the Roaring Fork Valley, and we call it our home because we feel that the sense of community is really working well.
What's the other end of that for families with someone with autism, where there isn't a community, where there isn't support?
So I'll answer it in the context of our summer camp. We have about 100 families who have children who come to our camp. Some are local, some come from other parts of Colorado, some come from all over the world. And so we see the whole gamut. We see the family who can drive into our parking lot, open the door, literally let their child out with their suitcase and wave goodbye and say, we'll be back in a week or two. We also have the family who has to physically help their child out of the car to make sure that they don't run off, to go to the nurse and hand over sometimes dozens of medications and dietary supplements and so forth, and to then go through the dietary issues that that child might have. We have some families who are still not ready to allow their child to be a residential camper with us, and so they take them home every day with them. So you see the gamut, and your heart breaks for some of those families because, many of them have never been able to leave their child in anyone else's care. The parents have never gone out to a movie. They've never gone out to a restaurant, and it's eye-opening.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Sevry.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, Carbondale residents have their say about the prospect of a new town pool.
Eagle County commissioners met with a representative from the Olympic Exploratory Committee.
The Banff Mountain Film Festival stopped in Aspen this week as it makes its way around the globe.
And Aspen City Council considered formalizing its climate action goals.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org. Elizabeth, did you watch the Olympics?
We watched as much as we possibly could and tuned in particular for women's hockey and that amazing women's cross-country ski race.
Yeah, lots of great events. And I'm in a little bit of Olympics withdrawal this week. So I'm excited to get a little fix with the next story. Aspen native cross-country skier Simi Hamilton recently took sixth in the Olympic team sprint. And you caught up with him on the phone after his race.
I did. Just minutes before his race, the U.S. women made history when they won the gold medal in that event. When I caught up with Simi, he was at the Athletes Village in Pyeongchang.
It was pretty unreal. It's unbelievable to be a part of that, to know that you're kind of part of that momentum right now. You know, it's been something in the making for a long time. I think we all entered these games knowing that our team was going to come away with a medal. I don't think anyone expected to be gold medal. So I think that just makes it, you know, even more incredible, even more special. And it's just so cool to be a part of that.
This is your third Olympics. Can you kind of describe the atmosphere and the environment or what might be unique about this time around?
Yeah, it's been a really cool experience. You know, I think it makes it extra special knowing that it's, you know, most likely my last Olympic Games here. But it's been really cool. They've done a great job with organizing everything. Obviously, it's a very windy region of the world, so that's been a little tricky for some events, especially, you know, a lot of the alpine events. They've had to reschedule and postpone a lot of those events. But they've, you know, done a great job with figuring all that out. For us, the venue is incredible. It's, you wouldn't really, I think objectively looking at it, you'd be like, oh, racing, Olympic races on a golf course sounds kind of boring, but they've done a really good job with all the courses, with all the streaming, the setup, the stadium area. It's been really cool. We pretty much had really good weather here. It hasn't snowed at all. We're skiing on man-made snow, which, you know, as much as we love to ski on natural snow, as much as we feel like that's true ski racing, it is nice to ski on artificial snow because it stays really fast, really hard, really firm. The conditions are generally pretty stable. It's been definitely windy some days, which makes for kind of frustrating training and frustrating racing. But in the last week, the wind has died down a lot, and it's just been great skiing. It's cool, you know. We spend a lot of time in Europe, but we rarely come to Asia. I think last year was the first time I had ever come to Asia for ski racing, just for the World Cups leading up to these games. And you know, you can tell that they're just psyched about kind of showing the winter sports world, you know, what they can do, and they've just been really good hosts.
Now, have you gotten a chance to watch any of the other events or any other athletes from the Roaring Fork Valley?
I haven't yet, just because when we're still racing at the games, we're pretty much training every day. When we're not training, we're kind of expected to be chilling out a little bit for recovery. But now that the team sprint is over, I'll for sure try to take advantage of getting out to see a few different events. You know, I'm hoping to go to an alpine race, maybe a hockey game. Definitely want to go check out the coastal cluster, go look at the ocean. Might try to do that this afternoon. Yeah, just really psyched to kind of get out of the athlete village bubble a little bit and do a little exploring and try to take in some sights.
Yeah, what is the athlete village like?
It's been great. It's you know, it's comfortable and clean. It's like living in a kind of a little city. You know, we're in the main athlete village this year, which is really cool. In the past, we've kind of been in, you know, little satellite villages because the cross country venue is usually kind of separated from everywhere else. So this year, it's been cool to really feel like we're in the main thick of it. You know, they have a hairdresser, we've got a dentist, doctors, little store, kind of, yeah, it's like its own little functioning city here.
You'll go get your hair done before you leave?
Yeah, get that free hair done. I got to take advantage of everybody.
It's been really interesting to watch the Olympic athletes from Russia, and I'm wondering what it's like to be racing against them, if that feels like you're racing against sort of just any other athlete.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think, you know, I'm very optimistic of the situation. I think that I'm hoping at least that there's kind of a new generation of skiers from Russia being ushered in, you know, that are at least entering this racing world with the expectation that it's not okay to cheat and that they will get caught if they cheat. I'm very optimistic in thinking that you know, everyone we're racing against here from Russia is clean. And I do truly hope that that's the case. You know, it's cool to just see new faces.
How have you been spending your time when you're not training and racing?
That's a good question. You know, the nature of the Olympics is there's a lot of kind of logistics involved, and there's a lot of time spent riding buses, riding shuttles, going through security. A lot of time of the day is eaten up by either getting to where you need to go or getting into where you need to go or getting out of where you need to go. With the late races that we've had, you know, I think last night's team sprint was probably, I think that was the earliest race that I had all games, and that started at 5 o'clock for the women. We've all been definitely on a little bit of a different schedule. I've been probably going to bed at like 2 o'clock every night, 1:30 or 2, and then waking up at 11 or 11:30, just to try to kind of set our clocks back a little bit. It's not ideal to be like on a normal schedule and waking up at 8, and then just sitting around all day before you have to race. So the only race left is a 50K, which is on Saturday. It's 50 for the men on Saturday and 30 for the women on Sunday. We have to fly to Finland on Monday for more World Cups that start next weekend, and there's a skate sprint in Finland next weekend. You know, I'll take a couple days to kind of get the rest of my Olympic experience and get out to see a few different things and recover a little bit from the drain of Olympic racing, but then, you know, after a couple of days, it'll definitely be back to focusing and training for the final World Cup period that we have coming up next week.
Wow. So what's it like to be wrapping up your Olympic experience, but know that you're looking forward to more races and you're kind of still in the thick of competition season?
It's hard. A lot of the other athletes here, they're done after the Olympics. And so a lot of them, it's kind of an emotional release to be able to finish their Olympic event and then just kind of know that that's it for them for the season. For us, we always have 3 weeks of World Cup racing after. I'm really psyched for more racing. You know, I felt like these Olympics, it wasn't a letdown for me, but I felt like I didn't really get to showcase what I was, you know, could potentially do. You know, I wanted to win an Olympic medal, I think. You know, that's the goal of everyone competing at this level. And I'm for sure happy with, you know, how things turned out and had an incredible experience. I couldn't be more psyched for our team. But, you know, I definitely feel a little bit like I couldn't totally prove who I am as a ski racer. So, you know, fortunately for us, the World Cup offers us more chances to kind of do that, even though it's on a, you know, kind of a smaller scale. You know, we're still racing against the exact same people that we're racing here, and the World Cups are still super important. So hopefully I'll stay healthy through these next few weeks. A lot of people come out of the games and immediately get sick because they've kind of put in so much energy into just being at the Olympics, and their body's completely run down, and they get sick right before the World Cup starts again.
Okay. Good luck with those last few races, and thank you so much for making time to talk with me.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth.
That's Olympic cross-country skier Simi Hamilton on the phone last week from Pyeongchang.
The Art Base in Basalt offers a variety of classes for children and adults. One of the organization's newer courses is the Art of Healing and Hope. It's an art therapy class for cancer patients and people experiencing trauma and grief.
Claire Woodcock reports.
Everyone in the class has a reason for why they're here. The teacher, Sherry Gaynor, starts the session with a meditation before sharing her own story of how art therapy has transformed her life.
Through my own journey with addiction and also with depression has allowed me a space to move out some of those really deep, dark feelings and emotions and give them a place to go.
The program is a new partnership between the Art Base and the Callaway Young Cancer Center, but the class was recently opened up to anyone who's suffering from trauma. One of the only rules of class is to not comment on other people's art, because as Gaynor says, it's not about the final product, but about the process.
We're not here to make something necessarily that we're going to hang on the wall or, you know, show other people. But if in the end that is what you want to do with your piece, we celebrate that. But really, it is about just giving voice to something that typically we don't give ourselves the space to give voice to.
During class, Debbie Martinez-Brunn makes an accordion book out of thick sheets of watercolor paper. She and Gaynor met a decade ago, during Martinez-Brunn's second cancer diagnosis. She's now battling cancer for a third time, and she says the weight of the emotional hardship is heavy.
I just knew that I needed to express it. I couldn't just talk it. You know, I could say, okay, I was re-diagnosed with cancer, but I just knew that there was a lot going on inside me that I couldn't verbalize. And doing the art therapy was helpful.
So the idea is that there's many benefits to creating artwork.
That's Jenna Moe. She's the Art Base's executive director.
Especially in terms of recovery. So for people dealing with cancer, or in the specific case of this program, it's anyone dealing with grief or any sort of recovery, not just cancer.
She says the Callaway Young Cancer Center and the Art Base are hoping to grow the program because there's a need for it in this valley.
This is an opportunity for people in recovery outside of the hospital to get together and make art together.
Studies show that being creative is good for the brain.
It helps heal. So whether you're an experienced artist or a beginner artist, I think just challenging yourself to do something new and express yourself in that visual form can be really helpful and therapeutic.
After painting each side of the watercolor sheet, Gaynor instructs the class to rip their paintings.
Which was challenging for some people to be able to let go of the piece of art that they had created that expressed this feeling and emotion, which is all actually very much part of a metaphor of letting go.
That's when their pages became not an expression of grief, but an opportunity to heal. Claire Woodcock, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach. For Mountain Edition this week, I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in for Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. Allison Bechtesh takes a deep dive into the local headlines with a panel of reporters and editors.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Mm-hmm.